Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's absolutely wonderful. Do you know that's the first time in 2 years that I haven't been booed when I come on stage? And a great welcome, because as you know, ladies and gentlemen, you are seeing the man who for over 20 years has spent the whole time kissing and making love to the back of his hand. And a very lonely existence it's been. If I wasn't paid £700,000 a year to play Brian, I wouldn't do it. But plenty of time for my bitterness later. Now, I've actually been playing Brian as some... And incidentally, do we have any Archers listeners in here tonight?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for coming. The rest of you are in for a hell of a boring time. But, in 1975, I started playing Brian Aldridge. I actually played a character called Dave Escott first, who was a rather dodgy paint salesman who went to do up the bull, which was still being run by Peggy. He'd knocked off some paint and was decorating the bull, and if my mind serves me correctly, he even had a slight flirtation with Peggy, which I find rather hard to come to terms with. Anyway, I was having lunch with Tony Shryan, who was the then producer, and he said, well, I'm sorry you're going, Charles. This is after 6 months. He said, I'm sorry you're going. I said, well, I'm pretty sorry too. He said, no, don't you worry. He said, we'll get you back in the programme on a much more permanent basis soon. And I thought, oh, come on, pigs might fly. But sure enough, about a month later, Judy Bennett, of course, is in the audience today, my wife who plays Shula. She came home from Birmingham and she said, you've got to ring Tony Shryan in the morning. You're going to play a new character called Brian and you're going to marry Jennifer. And of course, I was absolutely thrilled. Had I known what Jennifer was going to be like, I might... No. That isn't fair. I was, of course, as an actor, I was absolutely thrilled because, obviously, I was being given a chance to play a more substantial part than Dave Escott. And I'll never forget, we live in London, the script arrived, and there it was, the first script I'd ever had with Brian Aldridge on the front. Now, we do 4 episodes a day in The Archers, 9 o'clock, 11:15, 2:30 and 4:45. My first episode as Brian in March 1975 was the 2:30 episode. So I went up to Birmingham and I thought, well, I'll go to the canteen and I'll have a bit of lunch before I start recording. So I went round to the lift to go up to the 7th floor where the canteen is, and into the lift came the actor Jack Holloway, who for as long as I could remember had played the squire Ralph Bellamy. And I saw him, I said, Jack, how lovely to see you again after all this time. How are you? And he said, I'm terrible, dreadful. So I said, why? He said, I've just been written out of the ruddy programme. And the lift got to the 2nd floor and he went off to drown his sorrows in the bar. And I continued up to the 7th floor where the canteen is and got my tray of food. Well, I went over to join the table of Archer's actors. We always sit in a big group. And as I approached with my tray, they very sweetly said, Charles, well done. Welcome back. It's lovely to... I said, hang on. Before you do all that, I said, I've just met Jack Holloway in the lift, and he says he's been written out of the programme. And they said, oh, yes, you've bought his farm. Can you imagine how he felt when I walked in the lift that moment? Anyway, I had my lunch and then went down and prepared myself for playing Brian for the very first time. But my life as Charles actually began in Canada. My father wanted to be a fighter pilot and fortunately couldn't land planes. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have known him. And he was stationed in Canada and I was born. And back I came. But after the war, my father, like a lot of people that had been in the war, there wasn't a job to go to, and I think he had a tough time. Until he got the job that he wanted, the one he knew he would do for 20, 30 years. And I could tell, even though I was a tiny little boy, 4 or 5, the excitement with my mother and father, because I was an only child and we were a very close-knit family. But I could see how thrilled they were and how more relaxed they were now my father had got this job. There I was, aged 5, and my parents said, now tonight, Charles, please, we want you on your very best behaviour, because Mr. Peter Bennett, who is the chairman of your father's new company, is actually coming for dinner in our house. So I went upstairs and I was bathed and I was put in my pyjamas and I smelt nice and Peter Bennett arrived, although I hadn't seen him, but I was brought down by my mother to meet this man who was going to employ my father. And I was taken into the drawing room by my mother, and my mother said, Mr. Bennett, who was already talking to my father by the fireplace, Mr. Bennett, I'd like you to meet our son, Charles. And he broke away. He looked down and he said, how do you do? And I looked up and I said, how do you do? And then he carried on talking to my father. Which point I tugged at his sleeve. And I said, excuse me, but haven't you noticed my eyes? Because I was one of those children where you never think children can hear. And everybody always used to say, hasn't he got lovely eyes? Hasn't he got lovely eyes? And this was the first grown-up in my 5 years who hadn't said, hasn't he got lovely eyes? I could see the colour draining out of my father's face. But all was well, all was well. My parents sent me to Sherborne School in Dorset, where Brian Aldridge also went to, I have to point out. I was not a success at Sherborne, but it's a great place. Mercifully, I got into RADA. I don't quite know how, but I did. I did an audition speech and I got in. And I had two fantastic years at RADA because I did learn everything. I didn't do plays at school much, I just played cricket. So going to RADA and being trained as an actor was what I particularly needed. And I had a bit of a ropey start, but I had, fortunately, the full backing of John Fernald, who was the principal while I was there. He obviously kindly saw something in me that was worth keeping and worth preserving, because at RADA they chuck you out like flies if you're not achieving the goals that they expect you to. And John was very kind to me. I used to get sent for. Would you go and see Mr. Fernald? They'd say, and I think, well, here it comes. This is the notice. I'm off. And I knocked on his door once, first time, and I heard this voice say, "Come in." And I opened the door, and I went, "You wanted to see me?" And he went, "Just wanted to see the face." Bless his heart, he obviously saw something in comedy or laughter or something in me that was worth keeping at the Academy. When I left after 2 years, although I had the odd job here and there, the odd telly and the odd bit of rep, mostly I was out of work. But, you know, looking back on it, being out of work and doing odd jobs, various things, was a very enriching experience. I mean, I did a lot of market research. I'm standing outside and a pub in Acton on a freezing cold February day in a very threadbare donkey jacket. My hands have no feeling in them and I'm holding a clipboard, stopping the occasional person to ask them questions. I'm fed up as this sleet is pushing into my face. When at 3 o'clock it was throwing out time from the pub and I felt a tug at the bottom of my coat and I looked down and there was a little old lady and she said, "Have you got sixpence for a cup of tea?" And I said, "Go away, go away, don't be such a nuisance." And I went back to try and get somebody, and she pulled again. And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "No, dear." She said, "I meant, have you got sixpence for a cup of tea?" But of course, it's pretty boring. It is depressing being out of work a lot of the time. You want to get on. You've trained as an actor, you want to entertain. And out of the blue, the phone rang one day. A man called Peter Smith, who had been on the stage management course at RADA with me, said, "Charles, how do you fancy being an Italian gypsy in a children's television series?" So I said, "Enormously. But, I mean, if you're casting an Italian gypsy, why cast me?" He said, "The director, Dorothea Brooking, has said to me this morning, can you find me somebody who can make me laugh for 3 weeks in Hazelmere? And I thought of you." So Dorothea sent for me. I hadn't worked for about 9 months, and this frightening lady with short-cropped hair, very thin, austere glasses, sitting behind her desk, said, "So Peter says you can be funny, is that true?" Imagine how funny I felt, can't you? That wonderful woman, Dorothea Brooking, sadly no longer alive, I wish she was, changed my life from the point of view of my career, because she gave me that part. And she then trusted me with everything she did until, really, she retired from the BBC. And I then got into schools and children's television in a really big way, for 20 years, no less. Now, There is one story about schools television I've got to tell you, because I don't know if there's anybody here. I can't really see you that clearly, but anybody who's under probably 35 and over 20 will probably at some stage have watched television at school. Maybe there's some teachers here. Because there was a series called Look and Read, which went out 2 out of 3 terms a year. And I created a little character in Look and Read over 23 years ago now called Wordy. Wordy was a little character that would bounce around on the screen and teach people to read. And he used to go, ha ha, my name's Wordy. Hello, word watchers. And it was good fun. I know I'm slightly mad, but it paid well. I have to say, I must tell you, ladies and gentlemen, last year, to bring Wordy up to date, last year I was in a thing called White Teeth, a Zadie Smith novel. And I was filming it, and I was playing Sir Somebody, Somebody, Somebody. Frightfully grand, a bit like Brian, but in vision, really. And the scene started, I have to tell you, I'm not apologising, but you must prepare yourself for this. The scene started with Brian making love to this Jamaican woman. I never made love on screen before, and with a bit of luck, I never shall again. But this act had to happen, and I actually was doing it, you know. And, of course, we had to do about 12 takes, because, you know, the sound's never right, the lighting's never right, and all that. In one of the breaks, this lovely girl said we were talking about what we'd done, and I mentioned the fact that I'd been Wordy in Look and Read, and she said, you weren't really Wordy. Do it. Go on. I went, oh, my name is Wordy. Oh, my God, she said, I can't believe it. We loved Wordy. When I was at school, it was our favourite character. We were Wordy groupies, you see. And then we were called back on stage, and we started making love again. We'd been going about 6 seconds, and she looked up at me and she said, I never thought I'd be shagged by Wordy. Now, in 1972, Peter Skellen wrote a wonderful song called You're a Lady. 1972, I met Judy Bennett. Judy was coming out of a miserable marriage, as I was, and this was a good time to meet when Peter Skellen's song, You're a Lady, drew us together. And I think it might be interesting for you to know, however, that, as I say, we've both been married before. You may like to know that Judy's first husband was called Brian, and my first wife was called Jennifer. Judy and I got married in 1976. I inherited two lovely boys, Toby and Barney. They were 9 and 7 when we got married. But in 1979, Judy and I had our child of our own, little Jane Collingwood, who is now 24 and an actress. It coincided, Jane's birth, with me being in a production of Dirty Linen at the Arts Theatre. I was in it for 13 months, a very funny Tom Stoppard play. And I'll never forget, I watched Jane being born at the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead at 7:30. And at 8:30, I went on stage and did the play. And the following day, I met Tom Stoppard yet again. And Tom is so clever that when you meet someone at Tom Stoppard and you say, hello, Tom, you think, I wish I could have put that better. And he said, how are you, Charles? I'm fine. He said, last night, 7:30, I saw my child being born. 8:30, I went on stage. And I could see his brain going, ooh, that's quite intriguing. As far as I know, he hasn't actually written a play about it. But the Archers took over the Watermill Theatre in Newbury in the mid-80s. And we turned the whole place into Ambridge. It was a huge success, and we had a great time down there. In one of the scenes, Brian has to run on and rush up to Eddie Grundy and say, and another thing, Eddie, what happened to those 10 missing bullocks? On this one particular night, I ran on stage and I said, and another thing, Eddie, what happened to those 7 missing bosoms? Ladies and gentlemen, bosoms I can understand. But why 7? Perhaps only Dr. Anthony Clare could answer that if I was in the psychiatrist's chair. But I have diversified, like farming, I've diversified as an actor, and I believe entertainers should. You can keep sort of opening one door while another one shuts. In the 70s, I was a BBC World Service newsreader and continuity announcer. Not all the time. I was a casual. I slotted in when people went on holiday or were sick. I did it for 4 years. Well, this particular night, I was sitting in the green room at midnight, reading my Evening Standard, when a very distinguished newsreader of the World Service, John Wing, walked in, didn't see me. He just went to his cubbyhole, and to anybody who cared to hear, he said, "I pity the poor person who's doing the 1 o'clock. There's been a coup in Czechoslovakia, and they've named the new cabinet." He then said, "And what's more, they've named the old one too." I have never been in the newsroom so quickly. I spent half an hour trying to get some sense out of those names. And to my credit, I did. And when I went on air at 1 o'clock, I managed to get through the story about the coup in Czechoslovakia. What I hadn't had time to do was prepare the other bulletins. And I got to the last bulletin of this 10-minute session, and I had to say the word Assadabad. It's not a hard word to say. When you've not seen it before, it can be. And on this evening, I said, Assadabadabad. Because I'm competitive, I wasn't going to leave it there. Assadabada, abada sadafad. Not a chance. I can see the clock ticking round. And now to end the news, here are the main points again. I do the Czechoslovakian bit again, and I get stuck in Assadabadabad. And I saw the clock tick way past where I was supposed to finish. And very meekly, I went up to the Green Assembly where we did the continuity, and there was a very frightening woman with her half glasses. And as I opened the door, she just said, "Not one of your best ones, darling, was it?" So that was enough news reading for me. But one of the things I've really loved doing, ladies and gentlemen, is working with the comics that I've worked with. I've worked with Bernard Manning, no less. I did a series of Bernard Manning called Under Manning. I got the job because what they wanted was the man who they felt was the most opposite to Bernard Manning. And I feel rather proud of that. I actually got it by going up to his club in Manchester, the Embassy Club, and going on stage with him on a Saturday night and singing By the Light of the Silvery Moon. And I'll never forget, in front of the audience, he said, "Charles, you're posher than Prince Charles." And when we were doing the show, he came between programs once. He said, "Charles, I've got a problem. When I go home at the end of the week, my wife says, 'You've been with that Charles, haven't you? You're getting posher by the moment.'" And I said, "Isn't it funny, Bernard, because I go home to my wife and..." For 3 years, I worked with the late, great Roy Castle. I always proudly say he was the nicest man I ever worked with in show business. And Roy and I became great friends. We shared a lot of stories. I worked with Eric Morecambe, with Roy Castle. Eric Morecambe, very, very close friend of the Castles. Indeed, I believe, introduced Fiona, Roy's wife, to Roy. And Roy told me a couple of wonderful stories about Eric Morecambe. He said, "One day we had just had lunch. We were sitting at home. We're in the drawing room. We're having coffee. We're just relaxing. And the phone rang. And Eric got to the phone first. He just snatched up the phone and he said, 'You've got the wrong number. There's no phone here.'" He was a giant of a comic, Eric Morecambe. And I worked with Eric proudly 3 weeks before he died with Roy Castle. And he was in rude health, dapper, immaculate, and enormously generous to work with. That wonderful laugh. Hey, hey, hey. I always felt I should put it in a jar, and when I'm a bit depressed, just take the lid off and go, hey, hey. And when I got home, Judy said, "What was he like?" I said, "He was fantastic, but he was like a little ornament on a mantelpiece. And you feel that at any moment, he could shatter into a million bits." And 3 weeks later, he died. But he was a genius. As was Tommy Cooper, of course. Tommy Cooper. Sadly, not with us anymore, but you only have to go, and people love it.
"I went to the doctor. I said, 'Doctor, Doctor, I broke my arm in 3 places. He said, 'Well, don't go to those places.'"
I actually saw Tommy Cooper at the Savoy. Sitting opposite me at the table was the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. And I thought, by the end of the dinner, I will be engaged to that girl. And then they said, "It's cabaret time. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Mr. Tommy Cooper." Tommy Cooper came on, he said,
I could always tell if I like an audience or not within 3 seconds. Good night.
And we didn't see him again for 40 minutes. And when he came on, he was hilarious. When he went off, I leant across this girl and I said, isn't that the funniest man you've ever seen? She said, I think that's the most boring half an hour I've ever spent. Do you know, all her beauty left her that very moment, as far as I was concerned. I worked with Joan Collins. Yes. I mean, yes. remembering my wife is in the audience. Joan is absolutely wonderful. She's got one of the great twinkles, and this was a thing called Tonight at 8:30, The Coward Plays on Television. I had actually always rather fancied Joan Collins. I just thought, she is sensational. You know, as a boy, all those photoplay magazines and all that. So to work with her. And we got on famously. She was very giggly, very twinkly. And we got to the technical rehearsal before we did the full dress, so we just came on in mufti, like I am today. And she came on, I remember, in a beautiful pair of jeans. This is not long ago. Beautiful pair of jeans. Nice leather belt, pulled tight, beautiful blouse. And I said, gosh, Joan, you look marvellous. Wonderful. How do you keep such a wonderful figure? And she dropped to the floor and proceeded to do the sexiest press-ups you've ever seen in front of me, going, this is how I keep fit, Charles. Do you know, at that moment, somebody tapped me on the shoulder, an actor tapped me on the shoulder. Could I talk to you about your equity subscription, please, Charles? I said, no, you couldn't. But I did a quiz a few years ago with Joan Bakewell. Wonderful. It was an art quiz for Radio 3. And we went round all the festivals. Now, Joan is an absolute dear, but she has an authority about her that I've not met in many other people. And I remember on this particular occasion, we were travelling up to Leeds to record it in Harrogate. Now, one of our panel was Brian Sewell. I came in the room and the producer said, Brian, this is Charles Collingwood. Brian Sewell looked at me and said, I think you're an absolute bastard. So we were on the train. He did mean Brian, I'm happy to tell you. We're on the train going up to Leeds, and Joan started telling us about something. Now, it wasn't open for discussion. She told us for about 10 minutes about a subject, and we all nodded, we didn't say a word, because she was right anyway. But it had an authority that made it beyond question. When she'd finished, there was a pause. And Brian Sewell said, Joan, do you think you could possibly try to be a little less like Mystic Meg? When we got to the venue, Brian said, Charles, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to do a warm-up, a few jokes, and I'm going to read a poem. He said, I love the way you say the word poem. So I said, how do I say the word poem? He said, correctly. But I have to just pay tribute here to Vanessa Whitburn. Vanessa Whitburn is the producer of The Archers, and it's a big team that keeps us going. Well, the reason I'm going to pay tribute to her is that the two great stories that Brian and the Aldridges have had really were Kate missing. Kate went missing, possibly dead. They kept the story running for 8 months. Kate went in the autumn, came back in the spring. It could so easily have had that story over in 3 weeks with a lot of drama, a lot of tears, but they didn't. And so by letting it run 8 months, the Aldridges, with Kate, their daughter, missing, had to endure birthdays and work. Life went on, frankly. And that was a fantastic story to play, and by the reaction from the audience, very real for the audience. Of course, more recently, Brian has had this extraordinary story with the love affair with Siobhan. Again, one of the reasons I think that had such a dramatic effect when Jennifer and Debbie found out last Christmas was because the affair was allowed to run the correct length of time. There was a proper affair. Are you in the house, Siobhan? Somebody giggling. It was allowed to run the right length of time. And then, of course, when Debbie and Jennifer found out last Christmas, well, you know what hit the fan. Actually happened that when that story came out, I was in hospital having my hip done. I didn't actually have a hip replacement. I had a hip resurfacing. It's for the younger man. And I'll never forget. Papers were full of it. My surgeon, a very wonderful female hip surgeon, she came in to my room the day before I was due to leave, and she said, "Now then, Mr. Collingwood, you have a choice. Is Brian going to stay with Jennifer? Or is he going off with Siobhan?" And I said, "I can't possibly tell you." "Right then," she said. "Well, you won't be going home for Christmas." But then, in January this year, on the 29th of January, no less, I had the biggest surprise of my life. When at my elbow, at the last scene, on a Wednesday episode at 4:45 at 7 o'clock, at my elbow appeared Michael Aspel with the red book. "This is your life. My reward for being the best-known adulterer in the country." But I'm going to finish by telling you one more story. And that was what happened in November. In November, I was invited by Wendy Richard to be part of her tribute lunch at the Savoy Hotel. The Variety Club of London were giving her a lunch in her honour for 40 years in show business. And Wendy Richard is an enormous supporter of the Archers and a great fan of the Archers. So I was thrilled to go. But bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, it was before I'd had my hip done, and it was extremely painful at the time. So I went to the Savoy, I sat down, and I'm having this lovely lunch. And halfway through, there was a break, and Wendy broke away from her table, came up to me, I stood up, and she threw her arms around me, and in my ear she whispered, "Charles, Angela Rippon and I think you're the sexiest bastard in show business." Well, when you've got an aching hip, that's a wonderful thing. And I went out after the lunch, and I limped in a slightly inebriated way down the Strand. And I got the bus home up to North London, and I opened the front door, walked in, and there, as usual, was Judy. She was ironing, and I said, "Darling, put that down. I've got something to tell you." So she said, "What?" I said, "I want you to know that at the lunch, Wendy Richard whispered in my ear, 'Angela Rippon and I think you're the sexiest bastard in show business.'" And Judy looked at me and said, "Only in show business." So there we are. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Only in show business, no less. It's been fun sharing with you some of my more amusing moments of my life. But, you know, all of us sometimes can think, "Oh, I wish it had been like this, wish it had been like that, that might have happened." But I truly feel blessed for the life I've had, both in my work, in my wonderful marriage to Judy, and all my extraordinary friends. They're such a colourful mix. Because variety, for me, really is the spice of life. Thank you for listening.